Welcome to the Foresight Health Roundup podcast, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. This is a special edition of the Roundup. We're going to talk about the future of specialty care with Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital, and our special guest, Dr. Molly Coy, executive in residence at Avia, the platform that connects health systems with digital health solutions. If you don't know Molly or haven't heard or read about her, you probably don't know healthcare. Molly is the former Chief Innovation Officer at UCLA Health, and today is a board member or advisor to a number of companies, including Ginger, Amedisys, Cure AI Health, Redesign Health, Baby Scripts, and Hazel Health. Molly, welcome to the Foresight Health Roundup podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The idea for this special episode came from a lot of different places, but at the top of the list was a viewpoint published earlier this month in JAMA. It talked about a new Medicare billing code for inpatient infectious disease consults and whether the extra money from doing consults would combat the growing shortage of infectious disease specialists. And it wondered if creating add-on billing codes for other specialties would alleviate shortages in those areas as well. You know, in healthcare, we like to throw money at a problem, and that's the problem. So we decided to talk about the future of specialty care, or maybe more appropriately, the fate of specialty care, assuming we don't have more money to throw around. Molly, let's start with this question. We've been talking about the future of specialty care since the late 1990s, when Regina Herzlinger published Market-Driven Healthcare and her concept of focus factories. Why are we still talking about it nearly 30 years later?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, but I would say the two principal ones are, first of all, the number of physicians who are retiring early, leaving their field, includes specialists. So we're seeing the unmet need for specialist care just exploding. I'm sure you and Julie, and I certainly have, get tons of calls from friends who are basically saying, how do I find a neurologist? How do I find a cardiologist? The second factor in this, though, is that there's a great deal more to know in each specialty. The breadth of the research and our new understandings and the new treatments means that it's more important than ever that people get the specialist care that they need. But also, Dave, you know, Foresight Health has stressed the growing power of consumers in this new healthcare economy. And it's really almost impossible to overstate the despair and the rage and the hopelessness of these patients that I was just talking about when they can't get help. This is probably the greatest source of irritation and despair, in addition to just simply the cost of care. And so now we can see this frustration just on the brink of the huge cuts that are coming in insurance and access to care. So I would expect that this is going to be exacerbated highly in the next year or two. And I think most people running health systems have the same expectation. So the question that you're raising is whether the market will meet this need. And if so, how will they? So put it more crudely, will the market support new business models and technologies that can take the number of specialists that we have available in the market now and extend specialty care to everyone who needs it? For the next 5 years, at least, I'm really skeptical about this. In tandem with other trends in healthcare, I think we should expect to see a widening gap between those who can access specialty care and those that can't. In essence, the market will do what it should. It's maximizing the profit generated by fielding a scarce asset, the physician's time, and doing so for patients who directly and indirectly can pay the most. What we're seeing already are three forms of this market response. First of all, what you and Julie had mentioned of paying specialists more for the consults they provide is, as you said, Dave, just throwing money at the larger problem. It's a weak incentive, and it's not likely to change the landscape significantly. almost none of the institutional responses from plans, from specialty groups, from health provider systems will be expected to actually change this distribution of access. Second, the market could reward investors in new technologies that will really enhance the productivity of specialists. We've seen this in waves. Years ago, when EHRs ushered in the era of clinical decision support, most physicians, and particularly specialists, firmly rejected it. 10 years ago, several venture-backed companies introduced a new concept, which was a semi-automated specialist remote consults for primary care. This was known as the e-consult system. And again, specialists basically rejected this. It showed and was demonstrated with millions of patients to reduce the need for specialist visits by 40 to 60%, because these really could just be handled by a remote consultation with a primary care physician by essentially, at that point, a glorified version of email. But specialists and hospitals just didn't feel the heat at that point. They didn't feel the need. And the key point here is that the adoption of productivity improvements depends on physician acceptance. So the third, and I think most effective market response, will be to introduce Gen AI-driven productivity enhancements in formats that are more acceptable to clinicians. AI is rapidly proving that it can take on pieces of diagnosis and treatment across a growing range of specialties and conditions. And I'm sure that many of the listeners today will have read recently that Microsoft fielded a version of Gen AI that was 4 times better at diagnosis and treatment selection. They used a New England Journal of Medicine standard test set of patients, and these patients were not urgent care and primary care, which a lot of this has been targeted to initially, but patients with complex and multi-specialty conditions. Reviewing their methodology has led many of us to a more conservative conclusion than this 4 times better. But the key point here is that the AI did the work much more quickly and at far lower cost to arrive at the diagnosis. So it's easy to imagine each human specialist in the future running a network of AI agents, each one of them a mini specialist. So the question is given the market pressures, how is this going to evolve over the next 5 years? Will we see Gen AI introduced as a consult to specialists, or will it become the specialist itself over the next few years?
Your point about specialists and telemedicine is so true. I had one telemedicine visit with a specialist, and that was only because there was a torrential downpour here outside of Chicago, and she couldn't make it to the office. Every follow-up appointment since has been in person. It was a one-off, and she never went back to it. So really, really true point there. Julie, any comments or reaction to what Molly said?
Well, first of all, I wish we could all live in Molly's reality. It would be so much easier. And Molly, you know, I think back to the term e-consult, which we've been talking about for decades now, right? And as much as I'd love to see e-consult actually really make an impact, it hasn't scaled. And whether through incentive models that haven't really worked or the lack of real staffing models to support, you know, some of what e-consults turn into, like the theory of the practicality of what an e-consult is should be easy, and it still hasn't scaled in the way we'd like to see ultimately. But I think honestly, with these big, beautiful Medicaid cuts, I'd hope that we would just see a revival of how to bring specialty care to more who need it. I'm intrigued though by the way you talk about Gen AI. You know, I've sat with a number of health systems over the last few weeks talking about Gen AI. And, you know, you mentioned that it's been rolled out initially in primary and urgent care. And I think that actually is where it's had the biggest uptake. Some have mentioned specialties where it's had decent adoption, obviously radiology, cardio, some neuro. But what I've heard is that specialists haven't really been able to use Gen AI in quite the same way because it hasn't been deep enough, or I've heard some say personalized to what specialists need. And of course, I've also heard that surgeons will not use Gen AI, not shockingly. So I think your vision of the specialist agents, I can really see it coming. I think we're a long way, though, with both the technology and understanding how to get adoption. I think what we are seeing now, though, is that, you know, this first uptake of Ambient anyway has been largely around just making people's lives better. And a lot of the, you know, very, very hyper-focused ROI around it's been pretty, you know, lackluster. But now that we're starting to see other benefits added in, whether it's, you know, coding or other kind of next best action components, you can start to see how specialists would adopt and it would make their lives easier. And we could start to extend specialty care through that mixed hybrid of AI doc plus human. So I love your reality. I hope we get there.
Big, beautiful Medicaid cuts. I'm going to steal that, Julie.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, Molly. My second question is, what market dynamics or innovations happening now are changing the trajectory of specialty care in terms of supply and demand? Health versus healthcare, artificial intelligence, private equity investment. What do you think?
Well, in theory, what we would really like to have seen is that specialty care would be applied with higher quality and reduced costs in what we know as value-based systems. And to some extent, there's some research that supports this expectation, but we haven't really seen value-based care get the traction that we all hope to see in the last decade or so. When these huge cuts, and I also like Julie's formulation of big, beautiful cut, Medicaid cut. When these huge cuts in federal, and then we're going to expect, of course, rolling state cuts necessitated for healthcare, when they take effect, the extent of the chaos and pain that results are going to make it really difficult for providers to focus on transformations of any kind. It is going to be like the old adage about wartime is the mother of invention, but those are not multiple things that are very difficult and complicated to do. These are in situations of crisis where people accept a couple of big changes that are really important. In that kind of setting, Gen AI does have an opportunity. And I would say, Julie, that a lot of what you were saying of the reasons why the e-consult didn't get adopted over the last 10 years or so includes all the things that you were saying, but fundamentally it was that the specialist just plain didn't want it. And part of that is that the technology wasn't good enough and, you know, the coordination of information systems at all. But we're in a generation now of technology where Gen AI can do, and we see this in radiology, that the Gen AI can actually make life easier for the specialists and get them to accept it. It's a slow-ish process currently, and find that it makes their life better as well as improving the quality of the outcomes. With this higher market force of the desperation of the patients and the lack of financing for care, I would propose that Gen AI will be the driving force in creating models that meet consumer demand for specialty care. It'll either be in direct-to-specialist formats or within primary care-generated referral systems or specialist-to-specialist referral systems. And the reasons for this, first of all, AI learns and keeps up with advances in the science of medicine at warp speed in comparison with practicing specialists. Secondly, AI has been shown to be capable of more sympathy, and I'm sure you've read these studies too, and more satisfactory patient education than primary care physicians. And frankly, I don't think there's any reason to suspect that specialists will fare better in this. Your comment about not wanting Gen AI doing surgery, David, is very real. But in terms of explaining options and explaining post-operative care and all of those kinds of things, Gen AI can step in and do a great job. And lastly, as the Microsoft blog post findings suggest, when AI is instructed to find the most cost-effective means of getting to a diagnosis and getting to the appropriate treatment and monitoring the treatment to make sure that it actually is working, Gen AI does a very good job, much, much better than the clinicians. So there's going to be a lot of reasons why systems and multi-specialty groups will feel this as a reasonable option. So we saw, as you mentioned, under COVID, that under pressure, consumers did adopt to remote care. Initially, they did this, as you were describing, David, as real-time video interactions with clinicians. But eventually, a certain proportion of the population found text and chatbot-supported systems acceptable. As the AI offerings begin to incorporate voice and other system capabilities that make them more humanoid, we actually may see Dr. AI begin to edge into the field successfully. So for all those reasons, I think that Gen AI will push the boundaries on this more successfully and potentially at scale over the next 5 to 10 years. In the next 5 years, I think it's going to be really difficult. And the health systems, Julie, I think you described this quite rightly, are reasonably not ready to try to push their specialists because they're liable to push them out of their system and into other arms of other systems.
I'm going to make a comment here about computers being more empathetic than humans. That always cracks me up, right? and why isn't it a surprise when it comes to medical specialists, right? That's
what are you trying to say, Dave?
Oh, I think I'm saying it.
Well, if I can just add, we used to say in medical school that a lot of the surgeons, if they were going to give the bedside care that the patients really wanted with the empathy, they would need a personality transplant.
Oh, that's great.
That's going to be hard to do at scale.
That's great. Thanks, Molly. Julie, any comments or reaction to what Molly described?
Well, Molly just said so much. So I'll just pick on a couple of threads. I mean, as Molly knows almost better than anybody, we've been battling for a long time clinical data stuck in a bunch of what I'll call dumb devices or just not smart connected devices and a bunch of niche systems and, of course, Epic. Some of these new emerging Gen AI systems are almost creating another bucket of information. You know, some of these Gen AI that will read a radiology film and then produce what the impressions in the report is so that the doctor just has to read and customize. Fabulous time-saving tools out there. However, it creates another kind of blob of data. What I'm starting to see happen that I think, gosh, I would hope it would bring specialists along the way is systems that are using some of the AI scribes, ambient listening, you know, they're starting to look at how that streaming of data just becomes the record, right? It becomes the context. It becomes how, you know, future visits can Molly be more empathetic based on having more context from the last visit. Some systems, I will say a couple, not a lot, can see how that's a much better way of maintaining history than the cryptic, very billing-driven way that we document care in EHRs today. So why do I talk about this for specialty care? When you start to look at how agentic AI can be used, like Sara Vasey at Providence talks about this, how they've, you know, they've used agents for some pretty simple administrative tasks and have found that in some cases, those agents actually need to either be patient or be more empathetic. They've had to look at ways to make it so. So if you think about the issues that specialists take care of, having all this context streaming at all times and pulling ourselves out of the EHR and pulling in data from other systems in a more kind of connected data lake way, people are talking about how, you know, that's going to make care better. And I think specialists could actually deliver much better care with some of that automation that saves them time, with more context from the patient, and, you know, hopefully with some guided empathy. We'll see.
Julie, I think that's a really important point, that the fundamental thing here is the need for care redesign, as a sort of highfalutin term for the fact that care is fragmented and broken up, and it's frustrating for patients, and it makes it much more difficult for physicians to come accurately and quickly to the right kind of assessment of the situation, diagnosis, and treatment. The opportunity for Gen AI to pull rapidly massive different streams of data together is very real. But in addition, we find in the interactions where I've been involved with Gen AI systems for primary care, the interactions with the patients themselves on the part of the Gen AI is able to extract a lot of patient information about other sources of care. For example, mental health. Patients often get their mental health out of their healthcare system. And it could be a very important piece of understanding what's going on and helping the patient do what's needed.
I agree with you, Molly. The care redesign part is so critical. And so many conversations today are just pointing all to the tech. So 100% right with what I agree with what you're saying.
Molly, I mentioned private equity. What are your thoughts on that and how that's going to help the situation or exacerbate it?
Well, don't get me started. I think there's a lot of magical thinking about PE, frankly. Going back to what we were just saying about care redesign, PE is very effectively re-engineering the referral experience for patients from primary care or other specialists. What's important here, and some of it is very handsome in terms of the improvement in patient experience, the rapidity of gathering data and analysis, et cetera. But the critical thing here is that their whole approach is quite reasonably, again, as a market actor, to drastically reduce leakage and improve the referral processes. In order to do that, well, let's put that together with what we learned from eConsult, that 40 to 60% of referrals don't need an in-person visit. So what they're doing is engineering more cost ultimately into the system by making sure that there's a billable visit for each time that a patient is referred. When if they were really doing what's appropriate for the patient and the cost and the right care, they would be slashing the cost of the whole process of referrals for specialist care.
Julie, what's your take on that?
Listen, I'm not necessarily going to prop up the rate jacking roll-ups of specialists that are, you know, decimating health systems across the country. However, I do see that it does simplify a lot of the referral challenges we've had for a long time, Molly. There's just fewer places for it to go. But, you know, I don't know that PE really aggressively looks to technology or looks to complete business redesign as the answer to why they invest and how they look to exit. So I agree with you, Molly. I'm not so sure that it's really helping. Although if you really thought about how to ideally design technology into their work, you could actually really see how PE could reduce the cost of specialty care with the right reimbursement approaches. But I don't see it really happening.
So we're looking for more thoughtful PE investment.
And on top of that, we shouldn't let this go without commenting on the fact that the fundamental effect of PE at this point is the pattern of scooping up specialists with highly remunerated practices, and that's hardly helping to solve the general availability of specialty care.
Absolutely. It's making it worse.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Molly, last question for you. If we're having this conversation 5 years from now on the fate of specialty care, what are we talking about? How will the conversation be different?
Well, first of all, you know that for most of my later career, I have worked with digital tech companies in healthcare. And I actually built a tech forecasting nonprofit for many years that tracked the adoption and deployment of new technologies. So in general, I have a lot of experience in tech forecasting, and there's one adage that some of the listeners may know, which is that forecasters often get the direction of the future right, but they underestimate how damn long it takes to get there. So if we're sort of pegging this at 5 years, my bet is that most hospitals and health plans will still be decrying the lack of specialists and trying most of the same revolving set of incentives that we began the session talking about. But I also bet that there's a combination of three actors that will be close to dominating growth in the healthcare economy with regard to specialty care. First are healthcare institutions that have traditionally been very innovative. Think of Kaiser, Ochsner, Banner. Julie, you could add to that list. Secondly, independent specialist groups that see the future and throw their capabilities behind specialty verticals that really do significantly improve productivity and the patient experience and clinical outcomes. And thirdly, and this is the thing that people talk about, I'm not quite sure what the potential for this will be, but it could be a blockbuster, which is tech-based companies that are relatively unconstrained by the self-regard of specialists and apply Gen AI at the cutting edge to largely replace specialists. So which ones will win, I can't forecast, but I think the pot is already boiling.
Yeah, I think Dave Johnson thinks he could be an interventional cardiologist. Remember, he talks about doing it on a simulator.
Yep.
I'm not so sure I'd want him.
That's my doctor.
Reconnect. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
I know. He likes to disrupt systems, but I don't want him disrupting my personal health care.
That's great. Julie, any reaction or comments to what Molly said?
Well, first, I met Molly when she was running health tech, and she was legend then. And that was certainly more years ago than I care to count myself. But Molly, you're an even greater force today. And when I look at how you think about the world, it is coming, and it's taken a lot longer than either you or I would have liked it to take. You know, I think if there's one thing I've learned from you, you are the eternal optimist, you know, pulling innovation into reality. And I can only hope that your vision of independent specialist groups and tech companies find their way into the future pretty quickly, because, you know, the innovative health systems that you even referenced, Molly, it's funny, I had one of our portfolio companies ask me a couple weeks ago, who are the leading health systems today? Who's really innovating? Is it still Providence and Intermountain and Geisinger? And I thought to myself, gosh, there's so many more names than that. And I'm not so sure where I put those names today. And I had to reshuffle in my mind, well, what does it mean to be an innovative health system? And I worry about where health systems are, because even those, and I think there are plenty out there who are thinking in an incredibly innovative way about care redesign, about technology adoption, about building beyond Epic, about enabling, you know, care in the right site, different sites of care, all the things that we talk about. What's happening with the big, beautiful Medicaid cuts is a problem. Margin pressure is still major. And there are only a few systems I've seen that have really kind of overcome the margin pressures to return to as good or better than they were pre-COVID. And I just continue to see, you know, newer models skim off the top to make systems weaker. So, Molly, I don't know if that tech giant is going to be the answer, but I certainly see, you know, different constructs than we have today. And it's not 5 years, it's longer.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. And thank you, Molly. I had to wait more than 6 months for my first ever checkup with a dermatologist, young doctor, mid-30s, and he had a great business model. He'd zap off benign moles with liquid nitrogen for a fixed fee, and he had a special that day. You know, it's like a hot dog stand or something. It was 5 moles for 200 or 10 moles for 300, so I went with the 10 for 300, right? I don't know. That's just a very retail business model for a specialist. So maybe that's the future. We'll see. This has been a great discussion. Molly, thanks again for being our special guest on the Roundup.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can subscribe to The Roundup on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes or a little more in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.